Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp.
Okay, well, just welcome to the Influential She podcast. We're just very excited. I'm here with Mel Schopp, and we are so excited about our guest today. It's Debbie Shore. She was the co-founder of Share Our Strength that really got going in 1984 with her brother Billy, which is an amazing
long time ago
to really think about eradicating child hunger in this nation, which is a big bite and something that we've really seen increase over time. You also were involved as a political organizer and a fundraiser with, what was it, Gary Hart's campaign?
It was, yes, Gary Hart's campaign.
Wow. Which,
yeah.
So really a depth and breadth of information and experience that brought you to this day. Why don't we just start, Debbie, with just give us a little bit of your background.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I'm glad that you kind of tied the Gary Hart campaign right into Share Our Strength, because there's just a really important, you know, integral link between the two. So when we started the organization, which actually was inspired by the Ethiopia famine. So 1984, terrible famine, and we were working in politics at the time. And Share Our Strength was the brainchild of Billy, my brother, the founder and the co-founder. And at the time, he just felt like there are some things that politics can't or won't address. And this Ethiopian famine crisis was one of those. And so from a political background, a really strong political background, we kind of made this right turn and decided to start Share Our Strength. Really very much, I always describe for Billy, and he could probably describe it in his own words, but I feel like for him, it was a physical response reading about the Ethiopian famine. The first time we had seen this kind of threat to millions of families and kids were dying of starvation. And so we started the organization with this, you know, very profound sort of thought that everybody has a strength to share in the fight against hunger. And we did it also with the thought that restaurants would be the ones to go to because they feed people for a living. They'll understand hunger in a way that not everybody might. So, you know, that was really the inspiration behind the organization. Then, of course, we quickly turned. We still have an international footprint, but we quickly turned to the U.S., which is also having a hunger problem.
So, tell us a little bit more about Share Our Strength and its mission now, and how you're, you know, working with other people in the nation to try to eradicate this for kids.
Sure. See, so when we first started, as I said, we were, you know, interested in very broad hunger and poverty work in the United States. And we started talking to chefs, and we ended up doing this event called The Taste of the Nation, which is still around today, 30-plus years old. And at the time, I mean, for many years, for like the first 20 years of Share Our Strength, we were raising money, and we were granting it to all over the country. We were granting it to organizations that were fighting hunger, mostly through food banks, right? So we would do an event in Boston, and we would give the money that we raised to the Boston Food Bank. And the event was a tasting event. Now there's thousands of them. At the time, we were kind of one of the few on the block, the only national organization that was organizing chefs to do this kind of thing. And we would have, you know, 50 of the best chefs in Boston. We would do an event where they would bring their, you know, a taste, one of their dishes, charge folks to come in, and then build sponsorship on top of that. And we did that for like 20 years. And, you know, it was a nice thing to do. It worked well. But after 20 years, we started to think about, where do we want to be in the next 20 years for Share Our Strength? And how do we want to parlay everything we're learning into something that we can actually measure and rally people around? And through a lot of work with food banks and other hunger organizations, we recognize that childhood hunger is something that, in the words of Jonathan Kozol, somebody we always quote, who's an author and a social activist, pick something big enough to matter and small enough to win, something I always think of as inspirational but achievable. And with 16 million kids struggling with hunger, big number, but achievable. And so we started to understand, why are kids hungry in America? Where are they? Where do they live? Why are they hungry? And what do they need to really alleviate this problem? And so the No Kid Hungry campaign was born out of that interest in addressing the next generation of kids. And so today we're an organization that is really diverse, still very big with the in the culinary community, but working with governors, working with mayors, working with teachers and principals and school districts and business leaders and corporate partners, all around this notion of everybody has a strength to share in fighting hunger. And, you know, like so many other, there's all these issues out there that are important issues, but don't have an easy solution. Mm-hmm. And childhood hunger is one of those that does have a solution, right? It's like, you know, getting food to kids should not be that hard. Ending poverty is really complex, but feeding a child is not. And so we've turned our attention to making sure the kids have access to the food they need to grow and to thrive.
Wow, such a great story.
Yeah. So, Debbie, you're here today, but I know that this isn't where you started your career. So yeah. Let's go, take me back. I'm just really curious about, you know, before you and Billy joined in this venture, even before your political work, what was that early and what was your aspiration? I think you grew up in Pittsburgh.
Grew up in Pittsburgh. Yeah, grew
so
up in Pittsburgh.
Go from there, because I'm just, I don't know if I know all of that piece of it. So
sure.
I'm curious.
Well, I grew up in Squirrel Hill, which is a Jewish community in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And went to school in Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, a party school. Mm-hmm. And started out in communications. I don't know why, but I quickly changed my major and started to study literature, which I loved. And then I added philosophy to that because I was taking a lot of independent courses and loved the combination of philosophy and literature. So I double majored in both, graduated, had no idea what I was going to do, ended up going to London and working as a chambermaid for almost a year in London. Yeah. And just traveling around Europe and getting to, you know, kind of just being on my own and trying something new. But then when I came back, I applied for a job with an international education organization called the National Association for Foreign Student Affairs. It's a real mouthful. Huh. And I was a secretary there for a couple of years. But one of the things that I am grateful for was my boss at the time recognized in me that I had a good sense of intuitive skills about people. And she kind of took me off being a secretary and kind of brought me into her world. She was the director of, it was a trade association. Mm-hmm. And I got involved in doing some hiring and helping her with staff and things like that. And I did start to develop, I think, kind of an intuitive sense around people, which is a great skill to have, obviously. Did that for several years and then, I think, 3 years, maybe. And then my brother, who was in politics here in Washington, worked for Gary Hart. He was a junior senator from Colorado at the time. And my brother was one of his legislative assistants. And he asked me if I was interested in volunteering on the Hart campaign. He was going to run for president, pretty unknown junior senator again at the time. And so I volunteered on the campaign and then they hired me as a receptionist, which was a great job because in those days, you know, you answered the phone and you talked to everybody, nothing was automated, and you wrote down on a little pink slip messages. And I was learning by just answering the phone so much about who was calling, where they were from, why they wanted to talk to, you know, either the senator at the time or somebody on the campaign. So I did that for about a year. And then I was hired as a fundraiser on the campaign and then a field organizer and sort of took off from there. But that campaign, what we learned in that campaign was so important for starting Share Strength. It was really the bones of the, but it wasn't something that was conscious in our minds. Mm-hmm. Everything we learned on the campaign was sort of buried, I think, at least for me. Things like the power of big ideas. You know, Hart was a candidate of big ideas around armed services and energy and youth in America, service, things like that. And those ideas have real power and you should listen to them. You know, I always tell people, you know, if you have a little idea that's percolating in your head, listen to it. Not that they're all good, but if it stays with you, it's important to listen to that voice. So, you know, that campaign was just a real school for us. I mean, it was a real learning institution, if you will. I think the biggest thing for us was, And I think it goes to networking, is this idea of what we considered concentric circle building in the Hart campaign, which was we were totally unknown. We were running against Walter Mondale at the time, who was the institutional candidate, the party candidate. And it was really down to Hart and Mondale at the end. But he was unknown. So how do you how do you run a campaign if you're not known? And since Hart had run McGovern's campaign in 1972, who was also an unknown, he understood some key strategies, which he brought into our campaign. And the biggest one was just identifying key people in New Hampshire, where we were, you know, the first contest, in Nashua, in Concord, in Manchester, in, you know, on the seacoast, all of the places where you had to have a, mm-hmm. Stake, in the campaign, and find one person, just one. And we're thinking, one person, don't we need like a lot, hundreds of people to put up yard signs and make phone calls and all kinds of stuff? Just find one person, get that person involved in the campaign, that influencer, and that person will bring everybody with you. That, not the message, but the work involved there. I mean, that was a message, but it was also our strategy. Of course, we won New Hampshire mm-hmm. and went on to really do a lot of great winning in the South, lost the nomination, but had a very formidable campaign because we organized around this notion of concentric circles, which is exactly what we brought to Share Our Strength in 1984. Exactly. I was staking out Stephen Piles and Alice Waters and Jimmy Schmidt and all these chefs that were in different cities. Mm-hmm. I was getting them to buy into what we wanted to do at Share Our Strength. They brought the culinary community with them. And everything we do today is really, it's not the only way to organize. It's the way I understand how to organize. And so that was just a really important piece of our growth.
Debbie, I think you've really tapped into something that we've spent a lot of time talking about. And we think this is a really important lever to accelerate your influence as a woman, is this practice of connection. And you've talked about how you take your energy and you are thoughtful and kind of intentional about what there's connections for just for fun and in your social community and all of those. But when you're really wanting to move something forward, it's important that you get focused, intentional, start thinking about who can help bring other connections. Can you talk more about that? And what does it, as a woman of influence yourself, like, how does that feel? I mean, what advice can you give to women?
Well, I think, it was a necessity for us, right? We were completely unknown at the time, and we weren't in the restaurant industry. We had never worked in the restaurant industry, and yet we were trying to organize the restaurant industry. So it was kind of sort of second nature to say, let's go and talk to influential restaurateurs about this idea, mm-hmm. which is exactly what we did. And I think, number one, when you talk to an influencer, you're giving them some adoration just by saying, hey, I remember the first one I talked to was, he's not around anymore. There was a restaurant on Capitol Hill called La Brasserie, not too far from Union Station on Massachusetts Avenue. And it was one of the great French bistros or brasseries at the time. And a lot of important people from Capitol Hill ate there. I would imagine members of Congress and stuff like that. And I went to talk to him, and he was a very tough guy to talk to. Didn't know me at all. And I presented what we were trying to do with Share Our Strength, which was very simple. We were actually asking restaurants for contributions, $500 or $1,000. We would put a logo on their window, letting the public know that this restaurant was supporting global hunger. And then we would promote that logo through public service announcements. That was the original idea behind Share Our Strength. And we kind of quickly learned that $500 or $1,000 cash is a lot for a restaurant just to write a check. They did it. We got, several thousand dollars that way, but it wasn't the way to really sustain that. And so by getting them involved in a big event where we're, giving them exposure and giving them a chance to promote their work was a much better path. But talking to Raymond at the time and telling him, hey, you carry a lot of weight in this town. And if you do it, other people are going to follow. I mean, I knew that instinctively, right? And we got him eventually. He was our first check ever. So I think it's a question of, I think it's a good strategy, but I also think it's a way to really say to somebody you're important, and everybody wants to feel important.
But so, Debbie, though, I'm thinking, though, when you say that, it's a genuine adoration, number one, correct?
Yes.
I mean, people understand that. But I think what's really interesting is I'm thinking about you going out, making kind of these, almost like a cold call. Here's this female walking into these. And a lot of times, I'm assuming that most of the chefs were male. And so
they were all
male
for a long time.
Okay, for a long time.
Jean-Louis Paladin was the second one. Roberto Dona was the third one. These are all some of the original great chefs of Washington.
Yeah. Wow. And so how, when you made that connection, I mean, I'm sure you saw yourself change over time, or how did you see your approaches to that, and how did you use, because now you've got the influence to be able to say, hey.
Well, you know, one thing we always talk about is that was 32 years yep. ago, 34 years right, ago. Nobody right. knew us at all. Mm-hmm. So those people, in my view, they're a very special place in my heart for the early adopters mm-hmm. who were strictly, yes, did I have something to do with it? Did I inspire them in some way? I guess I did. But mm-hmm. I also had an idea that was really right at the right time. This idea we had to organize restaurants and chefs around hunger mm-hmm. was unique, and they had been waiting for it, turned out, to be organized around something important, and it spoke to them because it was hunger. They feed people for a living, not just their tummies, but their soul. Chefs understand what food does for people like nobody else, right? Because they see in their customers' eyes, you know, what they've just delivered. And so, you know, yes, I think you have to have some passion when you talk to people. And passion is just one of those funny words, you know. It means a couple different things to people. I think, you know, I get pretty excited about our work and I'm not afraid to talk about it. And I think that's another piece. You have to be confident and feel excited about what you're talking to people about if you want them to be excited and open and interested. So, you know, Jean-Louis and Bill Timberlake and Raymond Campe and all these folks, they were like, we didn't get a no, to tell you the truth. We got, but these were I went to their restaurant and I knocked on their door and I said, I'm Debbie Shore and I want to talk to you about something. It does sound kind of crazy when I think back on it, because now that we have a name and a brand that people recognize a lot more, it's obviously a lot easier. You know, we've got 25,000 restaurants and chefs that work with us. We're only one degree of separation, you know, from really anybody in the culinary community. I think that's fair to say. A little bragging, but I think it's probably true. I can't think of, you know, because in those days, you only had two or three names that people knew. Julia Child, Wolfgang Puck. I don't know, maybe Jacques Pepin, if you watch TV. But that was it. Right. And we caught the wave. We didn't know there was going to be a wave, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. That was not part of the plan. Like, oh, they're all going to be famous one day and they're going to have publicists and books and book tours and television shows. We didn't know that. We just thought people who cook for a living care about hunger. And we were as right. That's as true today as it was when we started.
You know, Debbie, you talked about a couple of things about passion and, you know, having a fire in your belly, but then also how important is it to show up in connection, to be authentically you? I mean, like, you were cold calling and going in, but you had some sense of who you were while you did that versus kind of moving around. Did that come through being in politics? Was that something you always felt you had?
It's a great question and a great thing to highlight, because I think it's when I interview people for a job at Share of Strength, I'm looking almost, not exclusively for, but as a key criteria for me is authenticity, because people respond to it. People respond to it, period. They may not always like who your authentic person is, but you will get a response. I'm not sure if I was always this way. I kind of feel like I was comfortable and able to talk to people about what I cared about. I think I've honed it, you know, over the years, I'm sure, at least talking about Share of Strength and learning from my brother has been a wonderful thing for me, one that I continue to learn from. It's important to have somebody that you learn from. It doesn't matter who it is. Happens to be my brother, who's an inspiration always to me, and somebody who's also very authentic. We're very different, but we each have our authentic selves. And I think, you know, when someone comes to me with an idea and they're authentic about it, yeah, I'm going to listen in a way that really matters. So I think it's a super important quality. And I think it also speaks to people's understanding what their unique strength is. Everybody has one. They might overlap. If you have an office, we have a size. We have a couple hundred people that work at Share of Strength. And they all have their unique strengths. I'm not sure I know what they all are or if they do, but I think it's an exercise that's really important is to understand what you do best that nobody else can really do. And that's a process for people.
I know one thing in your life that's extremely important to you because you talk about it when you podcast. It's in your bio.
My cat? No, my girl.
No, your girl, Sophie. And, you know, I know that as you're thinking about her future.
Yeah.
Not just as your daughter, but also as a female who's going to really make waves. What are some things that you tell her, which I'm sure you do, or what are you thinking about for her future as far as how she can be not just influential, but to make sure that influence leads to joy in her life, and it also leads to her finding the right, you know, passions and pathway. So I'm just kind of curious about that story and that relationship, because I know she's such a integral, important part of who you are today.
Yeah, she is. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think it's just the two of us, so we have a lot of time together, mm-hmm. you know. She doesn't crave mommy-daughter time because it's been mommy-daughter time since since she was born. I crave it, but she doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily. You know, I drill down a lot on what makes her happy. I want her to identify that and be honest about it. I think that's a hard thing in life. I think honesty, you know, in the big sense of the word, is the hardest thing to achieve in life. You think about all the times in the day that we're not honest mm-hmm. with ourselves mm-hmm. or with other people. A lot of gradations. I'm not talking about, you know, outright lies. I'm not talking about, I don't like your dress. I'm not talking about that kind of, I'm talking about the kind of honesty that we struggle with in our lives. And I think I want Sophie to be comfortable being honest about what she's happy about, not what other people think she should be happy about. Mm-hmm. And that started when she was little, and I don't think she's totally gotten there, but it's something that I've drummed into her, and I hope she does that, because when you're honest about what makes you happy, you have a chance to be happy. Mm-hmm. If you're not, you don't have a chance. Mm-hmm. And that's how I view it. So that's one thing I try to tell her. And I think she's had this boyfriend for a couple of years, and I tell her, it doesn't matter what he feels, it matters how you feel. That's something that took me 50 years to learn, right? It's not about, does he like me? How do you feel about it? And so I want her to be in touch with her feelings and her honesty. And I think that's a big piece of what she needs to be happy. Because she's my daughter and, her uncle, because she's my daughter and my brother's niece, she can't help but get a really strong sense of why it's important to be involved in something that matters in the world, right? And she understands, because she's come to every event and every big conference and has met so many of the people that I work with. She knows that hunger is a problem in this country and that there are people trying to bring a solution to it. So whether she's acting on it or not, she's getting all those big messages from the time she was, mm-hmm. could understand it. That people are acting on something that they care about, and that hunger among children is something that we're all responsible for thinking about. So I'm hoping that that is something for her as she goes down the line and grows up and goes to school, that she returns to that in a real active way, whatever it is that she ends up mm-hmm. Caring about and being passionate about. I'd be surprised if she didn't, given the world that she's growing up in, but you never know with kids, right?
You
just never know.
Well, because they become their own person, who they were meant to be once they are under.
That's right.
They come out from under your major shelter as a mom. And then you just really kind of have to, in a way, you're there to support them, but you have to let them go become who they were created to be.
That's right.
I think you talked about something really interesting that Melody and I have really talked about in connecting with other people. You tapped into both honesty and standing in your own truth, but then also not being so caught up in what other people think about how that is. So in connection, all you can bring is yourself. What another person does with that, if you're respectful and, just trying to, be there with whatever passion or connection, but you can't own the other side of that equation about how somebody reacts. And I think we've just seen in our own careers and, as women, sometimes we're maybe trying to fix things. And some of that has to do with, this sheltering, nurturing role that we play, not only just because we're moms, but because we're kind of biologically built that way to mm-hmm, do that. Mm-hmm. So I think you really tapped into something interesting about, needing to be honest and yet let others be responsible for themselves. Like when you said about Sophie, it doesn't matter what he thinks. It matters what you think.
That's right.
And how do you see that in connections you've made around your business and just as a woman of influence?
Yeah, I think with any, you know, with any issue that we, there are plenty of issues out there to adopt and care about, and they need champions. And if you are connected to your truth about that and you are equipped to talk about it and you can't turn somebody onto it, move on. It's okay. You find champions where you wouldn't think you would, and the champions you thought you really needed turn out not to be so much sometimes. So I wouldn't worry about it. And I had to learn this over time as I got older and had more experience at work, that, you know, things keep changing and that's okay. And I have a hard time with change, but it's okay to keep changing. It's okay when people end up saying, wow, I've given service for 10 years and I need to take a break and I need to start doing something else. Keep growing and keep finding new people to take up your cause. And don't get stuck on that one person that you think you need, even if it's a pretty influential person. You'll find somebody else. Keep moving forward. Maybe keep them in the back of your mind. Maybe ping them once in a while, but keep moving. And I really had to learn that, because I get stuck on, gotta get this person. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, new people are evolving all the time, and they're interested in your cause or your issue or your idea or your business.
I think what's interesting too is how you've talked about these multiple kinds of connections that you've made. And I think sometimes it gets a tunnel vision on, okay, so it's just, I need only chefs, for instance. But really, you had to broaden your vision of what that connection platform looked like. And so you just listed off earlier in the show just all these different people, right, that you connect with around Share Our Strength. So sometimes we have to move outside of who we think might be helpful to connect whatever.
And I also feel like we talk here about what we call unusual suspects. Because if you're a hunger organization and you have a voice in the hunger arena, like Billy's voice, for example, or anybody who works here, and you go up to Capitol Hill and you're talking to lawmakers and policymakers about the issues that we care about, protecting laws for kids, you know, they expect you to come in, and there's, I think, an automatic wall up, but they're going to hear you because they have to. But if you bring a business leader up, right, you bring a chef, you bring a business owner, you bring a multi-chain, you bring a John Miller, who's the CEO of Denny's, who's raised millions of dollars for the No Kid Hungry campaign, to talk to his members of Congress, they're going to listen in a different way. You bring teachers and doctors and pediatricians and principals, they're going to hear it in a different way. So you do have to get outside of your own world to make the impact that you need to, because I think people are sort of, you know, half closed to the usual suspect. And they're much more open to the unusual suspect.
This sort of reminded me, you talked about these unusual people, but I was just listening recently, which I do want you to tell us a little bit about the podcast that you do. I was listening to a podcast not so long ago about the Uncommon Table, about bringing people together who may not be, which really resonated with me, who are not the usual sort of what we would call suspects. It's
easy to get Jim Wallace from Sojourners.
Yes, that's, and I couldn't remember the name, but that was a powerful,
yeah, and
powerful
the chef
podcast
here.
Because it reminded me of those connections that sometimes it's comfortable to sit down with people you know or friends or people who might have the same ideas. But the idea of the Uncommon Table, which sort of expands itself to being those uncommon connections and relationships, was something that was really a powerful message to me, and how I need to think differently or think about the relationships that I feel comfortable with versus those that can really expand my own
world. I
love
that you brought that up, because that chef, he's a restaurateur in Boston. He has restaurants in Washington. And Jim Wallace from Sojourners was talking about this issue of bringing people together, mm-hmm, right? And then Michael, who's the chef, said, well, why don't I supply the table and you bring the people? And what got us thinking about, which we really want to do, is wouldn't it be great to have a chef? You know, a lot of these members of Congress live together on Capitol Hill, right, because they're only here for, you know, a couple weeks out of the month, and they go back and forth to their districts. And so sometimes they live in a group with other members. Wouldn't it be great to have a chef come and do a cooking demonstration with Democrats and Republicans in this very tense, divided time that we're living in of nonpartisanship, bring them together over a meal and have that be a place for Republicans and Democrats to have a nice meal and have a nice dinner and see what comes of it, see what kind of conversation. I love the idea of bringing people together like that.
Well, and honestly, one of the things that, you know, women have been so good at their whole lives is bringing people around a table, around food, like what you're doing, and share your strength. And I think where we're at is we're not only kids hungry, people are just soul hungry for this deeper meaning connection together. And many times that's around food and a table.
Yeah.
And so, you know, perhaps that's something we have to start thinking about, providing leadership to, you know, how do we get people just to a space where they can talk as people again and talk about meaningful things as people, but not around boardrooms or, you know, in these more formal settings that are polarized and people are stuck in position. In my work, I've been in healthcare for a long time, and I just finally was to the point where I can't get anything done of meaning anymore without getting them out for, if, you know, doctors, nurses, and other people. I'm just like, well, let's go have a beer. Let's have a cup of coffee. Let's get around a table. And then the magic started to happen again.
Well, food is such the connector. And you think about all of the interesting food that we have now in Washington with immigrants, right? We've got so many interesting restaurants now from Afghanistan and Syria and Russia and Israel and all over the world. And I just look at that as a step in the right direction, right? Like that, just having food from all over the world and chefs from all over the world makes a difference, you know, in one city.
So before we end, I do want you to talk a little bit about the podcasting that you're doing, because I think that that's such a, because that's been a, in listening to that, but I know you've done hundreds of them, or Billy, in connection with Billy, or Billy's done them as well.
I'm a
co-host.
So
tell us about your, yes, I know you're the co-host. So tell us about your podcast series, because I think it's really a great.
Well, we're very proud of this show, which is called Add Passion and Stir. And it was, we thought of it because we wanted to draw the connection between all these chefs we've been working with for all these years, the connection between food and all the issues that we care about, and the issues that are primarily connected in outcomes of hunger and poverty. So, you know, we think about how food is connected to education, right? When kids don't eat, they don't learn. We know this, and that's why our No Calorie campaign is so focused on school breakfast, after school, summer meals, making sure the kids have the fuel they need to reach their full potential. So hunger is an obvious one, but there are some ones that are not so obvious. We had a show on about the military and how hunger is such an important piece of what they think about in the military, because one of the biggest reasons why our primary age group of 17 to 24 year old kids don't serve is because they're not properly nourished, or they're too big or too small, and their teeth. Also, they have major dental issues when they get into the military because they have not been eating well, and they're not properly nourished. And so thinking about how, you know, even being, you know, well-fed feeds into our national security, certainly education, certainly healthcare. Food plays a big role in entertainment, in business. So I think there are endless issues that immigration, we can bring forth and have a chef on and talking about how food is that perfect connector with, you know, teachers and business leaders, and just, you know, really drawing a good, you know, kind of story around the importance of food and how it connects to all the issues we care about in the world.
Well, you're just amazing, Debbie, and the work that you've done and how you've taken this idea. And it's not just an idea. The idea is about how you're trying to leverage around your passion by connecting with other people. I think it's a huge story to tell.
I would say one thing that always surprises me when people come to talk to me about their careers, I'll have, you know, young people, you know, can you talk to my sister's cousin's neighbor's daughter who's in town? And I say, sure. And they come in. thanks for that strong connection. And they'll say, you know, I want to run a nonprofit. So, okay, like, what do you, you know, about what? They're like, well, I'm not sure. I want to be in the nonprofit world. And I always find that fascinating. Or someone wants to run for Congress, but they have no idea what they want to do. So, I mean, they're really skipping, you know, an important step in what is it that they're passionate about before they become that nonprofit leader, before they run for Congress, or before they wanted the principal of a school. You know, why? And getting in touch with that. And I think if you don't have that, your chances of being successful are not that great. And if you do have it, that's not a guarantee either. But I think it's a, I think it is an absolute must that you have to be excited about something if you want to run a nonprofit. There's got to be an issue that really drives you. So that's just another reason why that passion's important.
Well, thanks, Debbie. And
thank
we
you.
Will be looking forward to further connection with you down the road. And you've just been really inspiring for us as well. And so thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
So
thanks for doing this. Yeah. I love the topic of the show. So happy to be on.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.